Well, let's spend a few minutes with Job. Now, there's the notebook. So about a year and a half into the study, they were thinking it was a little long. So we had fun. This morning, we had the opportunity to study together what Job teaches us about man. This afternoon, we have the opportunity to discuss what Job teaches us about God, what Job teaches us about Satan, what Job teaches us about angels. Let's begin by talking about what Job teaches us about God. God is just. God is extremely just. From a human perspective, at times, we might even say God is too just. Now, that sounds like an interesting statement, but I think it's because we don't fully understand, or maybe the better word would be appreciate, what justice really is. Justice is doing what's right. And in so much as justice is in perfect alignment with the character of God, God's justice is always doing exactly that which is right.
Amen.
The judge of all men is not going to do one thing which is not just. Everything he does is just. Unfortunately, men will paint God as unjust. They will paint God as cruel. They will paint God as unloving, not taking into consideration that justice involves good and bad. It involves reward and punishment. Romans 11:22. How just is God? God is so just that He even allows Satan to have a day in court. Now that says something about the nature of our God. He allows the greatest enemy which he has ever had to have his say. That is just. And that does not fully make sense to me, because I don't know that I would let, if I had any enemies, an enemy of any great esteem, I don't know that I would let such an enemy have a say. That would be difficult. But God does it. God, in chapter 1, verse 6, allowed Satan to come before him, allowed Satan to have his day in court. Chapter 2, verse 1, allowed Satan to have his day in court. A few years ago, somebody asked in one of the sessions yesterday about questions and answers and how often you should have questions and answers and things of that nature. It may have been day before yesterday. I think it was in Brother Parrish's class. Great class on preparing sermons for the year ahead. I was hoping it would be a class handing out sermons for the year ahead. I thought, man, I won't have to write another one. Got 100 free sermons coming, but I was disappointed. Not with the class. The class was good, but I wanted more out of the handouts, you know. At Independence, we have a question and answer every fifth Sunday night. We have since 99. Love it because it helps to tell what the thoughts of the congregation are. You know, what's on their mind. I can get an idea of what they need to hear that I'm failing to address. A few years ago, the question was raised, how could Satan have been in the presence of God? from Job 1, 6 through 12, Job 2, 1 through 7. And that's based upon Habakkuk 1, 12 and 13. Art thou not from everlasting, O Lord my God, mine holy one, we shall not die. O Lord, thou hast ordained them for judgment, and O mighty God, thou hast established them for correction. Thou art of purer eyes than to behold evil, and canst not look on iniquity. Wherefore lookest thou upon them that deal treacherously, and holdest thy tongue when the wicked devoureth the man that is more righteous than he? And on Psalm 5, 4 and 5, Wayne Jackson in the book of Job, page 20, said, "It is useless to speculate as to how Satan was able to arrogantly enter into the Lord's presence on this occasion, except simply to say, the Creator," emphasis Brother Jackson's, "the Creator allowed it." See also 1 Kings 22, 19 and following. That's it. God allowed it. I don't understand it. It's not my place to understand it. God did it. It was the right and just thing to do. Brother Turner went a step further in his Systematic Theology, page 85. The answer to this question, and I don't know how many know it, but Rex A. Turner Sr. is the reason that Auburn University has a graduate program in legal. I don't know what the field exactly would be, but whatever the law degree is they offer, he's the reason. He's the first one that received a law degree from Auburn University. Well, he was a lawyer in his thought process and could have been a great lawyer had he not desired to focus upon Christian education. He said the answer to this question lies in God's justice. In fact, the answer lies in His system of justice. As a just God who is dedicated to all the principles of justice, He allows even Satan his day in court, his day to bring accusations against the saints of God. God is just. This book teaches us that God is just. We go further into the book to chapter 23, verse 10, and we see that from Job's perspective. "But He knoweth the way that I take." Okay, God knows. That's another important thought. "He knoweth the way that I take when He hath tried me." Okay, God is going to try me. "I shall come forth as gold." Remember Job 31, we said this morning, Job says, "If I had done such and such, I would deserve what I've gotten. But I didn't do such and such." Here he's saying God is just. Since God is just, I know that when I'm tried, I'm going to be found innocent. We serve a just God. A second lesson we learn regarding God is that God already had a plan, and it could already be known. That's Job 19:25. I know, there's a confidence there. I know that my Redeemer liveth. And that Redeemer would stand in the latter day. That Redeemer would be there for Job. And that whole context demonstrates that. Chapter 14, verses 7 through 15 demonstrates that. We mentioned this morning Job was a developing character. Job continued to appreciate this more and more through the book. But he had assurance. We were talking earlier about the dating of this book. Some maybe 2,000 years before Christ, he had the assurance that Jesus Christ would come and would save him. God had a plan, and it could already be known. Revelation 13:8, Jesus Christ is the Lamb slain from the foundation of the world. And Ephesians 1, 4 and 5 indicate that not only was He the Lamb slain from the foundation of the world, but He had a church from the foundation of the world. The Lord's church wasn't an afterthought. It was in the plan from before even the first words were stated, "Let there be light." Wonderful to consider God's plan for man. A third lesson that we see concerning God is that he is more powerful than Satan. I think sometimes we forget that. We'll address that more when we get to Satan in a few moments. But that's in chapters 1, verses 6 and 12, and chapter 2, verse 6. 1, 6 and 12, 2, 6. Fourth lesson. And this lesson is from Thomas B. Warren, and the text for this lesson is the whole book. A just God can allow man to suffer intensely. A just God can allow man to suffer intensely. That's another area where we struggle to understand how the justice of God can allow that. How can the justice of God take my wife from me? How can the justice of God cause my child to be sick? How can the justice of God cause my best friends to turn on me? That's not a reflection upon the justice of God. That's a reflection upon, in some of those cases, the inhumanity of man. And in other cases, the simple fact that we were designed not to be here for eternity. This isn't, in a very real sense there, our home. This is where we're waiting till we go to that home. Nature has in it laws of thermodynamics. Thermodynamics have to do with the conservation of energy, transfer of heat. Second law of thermodynamics says everything is running down. Everything includes you and it includes me. We are frail. We fall apart. It is not a reflection upon the justice of God that the bad things happen. In fact, it's a reflection upon God's goodness that we get to have any enjoyment whatsoever. We view God so wrongly, and we'll approach that idea again in just a few moments. Another lesson that we have is that God is sovereign. That's seen in chapters 38 through 42. In those chapters, we see that God is sovereign. God doesn't have to answer to man. Dad pointed out, my father-in-law was talking about when Dad spoke at Nesbitt a few years ago. In one of those lessons, Dad said, In God's speeches, chapters 38 through 41, God does not answer even one question of Job. Leading up to that, every time Job spoke, he was asking questions. How can this be happening to me? Why is this happening? God, why don't you kill me? Why did you even let me be born? Oh, if only I would have died in the womb. If only I had been stillborn. If only I had not known this. If the day I was born was stricken from the calendar. Well, why did this happen? If you or I were God, we would write the Bible very differently probably. Genesis 1, we would probably be saying, hey, I exist. Here are the proofs that I exist. That's not how God wrote the book. God's smarter than we are. If we had heard Job the whole time saying, why is this happening to me? Why is this happening to me? Then when we began speaking in chapter 38, we probably would have said, Job, all right, listen, my hands were tied. It happened to you because I had to give Satan his day in court because I'm just. That's not what God did. God didn't answer the first of Job's questions because God doesn't have to. God's sovereign. He did demonstrate His sovereignty. And His demonstration of His sovereignty helped Job, we realize when we get into chapter 42, to realize, you know what, I spoke too soon. I'm not in the position to suppose that I should know the business of God. God is sovereign. Another lesson is that God is beyond man. And that's tied to that same idea. But that's chapter 37, verses 23. I'm sorry, 37, 23 and 24. One of these days I'll get somebody else to write my notes in my Bible. Chapter 37, verses 23 and 24. Number 7. Satan was never omnipotent. In fact, God had to allow him to touch, quote unquote, Job's goods, Job's family, Job's body. If Satan was omnipotent, or if he were omnipotent, don't you think that he would have, boom, family dead. Boom. Sick, nigh unto death. But he couldn't. And he certainly is not omnipotent today. So God is first, Satan is first, not omnipresent. Second, not omniscient. Third, not omnipotent. But fourth, Satan must answer to God. Job 1:6 and 2:1. And one of these days, we're going to be standing before God on the day of judgment. And we're not going to be alone, because another one that's going to be standing before God is Satan. Satan has to answer to God. Job 1:6, Job 2:1. Job is real. I mean, Satan rather is real. Job was real. And he still is. He's in paradise. But Satan is real. Let me read for you a quote from Adam Clark. It is now, let's think about Adam Clark for a second, boy. Adam Clark lived 1715 to 1832. Actually, that doesn't sound right. He would have been 117 years old. All right. He lived 17-something to 18-something else. Let me put a question mark by those dates right there. Adam Clark, he said, "It is now fashionable." When's he writing? Sometime 1700s, 1800s. "It is now fashionable. We are 200 years past that. It was already fashionable. It is now fashionable to deny the existence of this evil spirit. He, Satan, well knows that they who deny his being will not be afraid of his power and influence, will not watch against his wiles and devices, will not pray to God for deliverance from the evil one, will not expect him to be trampled down under their feet who has no existence. And consequently, they will become an easy and unopposing prey to the enemy of their souls." Friends, Satan is real, but he doesn't want you to know it. He wants you to think that God isn't real. He doesn't care whether you know he's real or not. He would prefer that you don't know that he's real. You don't worry about Satan. You don't need God. Satan is real. Number 6, Satan is the adversary. In fact, in chapter 1, verse 6, Satan came also among them. The American Standard translates that the adversary. He is the adversary. Number 7, you can read the first two chapters and see this over and over again. Then look at all the times that Job's sickness is alluded to beyond, and you can get the same idea. But number 7, he is vindictive and cruel. Satan is vindictive and cruel. And chapter 1, verse 6, Satan is an angel. Satan is an angel. He appears with the sons of God there. Well, let's talk about angels in the 2 minutes and 30 seconds that we have left. And that's good. There's not a whole lot in the book about angels. We can knock it out fairly quickly. The first thing that it teaches us about angels, and I've got to be careful about this, is, because I know that there may be people that disagree with me, and that's fine. I think this book teaches that there are no guardian angels. Why do I think that? Where's Job's? Where's Job's guardian angel? Where are Job's children's guardian angels? Were they off that day? And I realize that that's, you know, that may be a controversial point, and if you don't like it, that's fine. My tiny mind is perfectly fine to be wrong there. But I don't see guardian angels. Number two, literally or figuratively. Number two, angels are subject to God. Again, chapter 1, 6, chapter 2, 1. But then one other thing this book tells us about angels, and this is really neat, is that angels rejoiced at the creation. Turn with me, if you will, to Psalm 38. Not Psalm 38. We're in Job. Job 38. Job 38. In this chapter, God is helping Job to appreciate where Job was at the creation. Remember, God doesn't ask for information. He asks for contemplation. Verse 3, "Where wast thou when I laid the foundations of the earth? Declare if thou hast understanding." What that means is God can be sarcastic as well. Verse 6, "Whereupon are the foundations thereof fastened? Or who laid the cornerstone thereof?" Look at verse 7. "When the morning stars sang together, and all the sons of God shouted for joy." The angels rejoiced at the creation. Isn't that a wonderful thought? Thank you very much for your time today.